here.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Colleagues, today is March 7th. We have a couple of things on the agenda, and looks like a fair amount of interest in at least some of those things. We'll start by opening a work session on HJM 7. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, HJM 7 urges Congress to increase investment in Drinking Water State Revolving Fund and the Clean Water State Revolving Fund to upgrade and repair public water and wastewater systems. It has no revenue impact nor a fiscal impact.
Okay.
Chair Bailey, I move House Joint Memorial 7 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves HJM 7 to the floor with a be-adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And we will assign Representative Dembro as the carrier of the measure.
Because he's not here.
Well, and yes, to be.
Can we put stipulations on time frame? Is that possible?
No comment, Mr. Vice Chair. And close the work session on HJM 7. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2694. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2694 requires the Oregon Department of State Lands to study issues related to the development of energy resources in Oregon's territorial sea. It requires study to include issues related to the sharing of territorial sea mapping information generated by entities developing energy resources and fees paid by developers of energy resources to be used to pay costs relating to Oregon State University's territorial sea mapping project. It requires a study to be given to the Legislative Assembly on or before November 1st, 2013. It repeals the measure on January 2nd, 2015, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. There is a -1 amendment for this measure. The effects of the committee amendment, it replaces the measure. It requires any entity developing energy resources in Oregon's territorial sea to share any mapping information with Oregon State University's territorial sea mapping project. It allows the director of the Department of State Lands to adopt rules or take action necessary to implement the process. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Representative Boone, care to kick us off and introduce your panel?
I sure would be happy to.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And we're here today with yet another seafloor mapping bill. And I see smiles because some people who went through this last permutation with me literally would meet me in the hall with one of these. But we are here today to present House Bill 2694. We have an amendment that we are working on, and we will be, because I know this is not set to be worked today, but we wanted to tighten up a little bit of the language that we've been discussing. But this is a mapping of the territorial sea for the benefit of the safety of navigation, because some of the charts are in the 1800s, and I think they need updating, and habitat science, wave energy, tsunami modeling and mitigation, coastal erosion, sediment transfer, and sea level rise, and those are in order of priority defined in a document from OHSU Mapping Lab. This mapping lab is headed up by Dr. Chris Goldfinger, to my right, who you'll hear from today. I'll let him tell you about the project and how much has been completed, how it's been funded throughout history. And House Bill 2694 is merely another tool in the toolbox to get to the remaining region of the territorial sea mapped, and specifically engaging the ocean renewable energy sector. The -1 amendments will identify one way in which we can achieve this goal by requiring a device developer to share seafloor mapping data with the OSU project once their project has been permitted. This data is considered public at that time, and it's just a way of helping the mapping lab get to the completion of their project. So thank you for your time and consideration of this bill. And other person to my immediate right is Jason Bush. He's the director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. So I'm not sure how you want to go. Do you want to go first? Dr. Goldfinger has a presentation.
Okay. Dr. Goldfinger.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. I have just a couple of slides that...
You have to identify yourself.
Oh, sorry, I'm Chris Goldfinger from Oregon State University, Department of Marine Geology. And let me get this thing going. So I just want to give you a very brief summary of what's been done to date in seafloor mapping. Obviously, Oregon is responsible for state waters out to 3 miles. And in 2009, we had only 5% of that territory had been mapped. And we had marine reserves coming on, wave energy coming on, and so forth. And at that time, a state bill was passed to fund a project to begin working on mapping the territorial sea. And that bill, it turns out, leveraged about four times that number of resources from the federal government. It happened to coincide with the stimulus package, and so the feds put in $5 million. And the net result is what I'll show you now. So scientific consensus gathered around mapping the territorial sea, and in fact other states have done the same thing for a number of reasons in recent years. Tsunami inundation modeling is a big reason. We sit on a subduction zone, and to model what's going to happen when Oregon's tsunami happens, bathymetry data is required to actually do that sort of modeling. So this is an important thing for the state of Oregon. Wave energy is a big issue right now, and to effectively put in wave energy devices, either single or large wave energy parks, you need geophysical information about the environment that they're going to be anchored in and the wave climate that they're going to be in, going to be operating in as well. Marine habitat science is quite important, and back when we only had 5% of the territorial sea mapped, we were in the process of discussing marine reserves all over the state, and we had very little to go on. And so the seafloor mapping project went in parallel with marine reserves and actually got enough of it done just in time to inform that process. Coastal erosion and rising sea level are big issues, and a lot of people live along the Oregon coast, and the coast is mostly retreating, and this is a function of wave climate and the local geology. So this is an important issue for nearshore mapping also. And finally, safety of navigation. As Representative Boone mentioned, much of the Oregon margin is still operating on charts that were collected in the 1890s, 1920s, 1930s, and so forth. And relatively few areas have been mapped with modern data and generating new nautical charts. So that's an important issue. And Oregon is not that high on the Fed's radar to get this done. So it's been a really big thing to have Oregon self-start and do a lot of this. So I'm going to skip through these kind of fast. But this is the original plan, and we thought with the leverage funds and the state funds that we could complete about 35 or so percent of the territorial sea, being a little bit pessimistic about fuel prices and weather and so forth. And the priorities at the time were centered around marine reserves, rocky reefs mostly, and tsunami modeling. So we used mostly local vessels to do the work and hired local crews. Here's a couple of them here. And here's a couple more. So we used four or five local boats total. Some of the trips out were actually combined mapping and crabbing trips, which was kind of interesting. And we used local talent and local shipyards to build the gear that we needed as well. So the idea was to keep the money in, to keep the state money in the state. And here's our happy crew mapping away. So in the end, we started with about 5 to 6% or 6.4% of the territorial sea mapped, and in the end we wound up at quite a bit higher than we thought we would be. We had good luck with weather and fuel wasn't too much, and so we wound up at about 54% over the 2.5 or so year project. And here's some shots of sampling, ground truth sampling here with grab samplers and with video tows to ground truth the geophysical data that we collected. And so in the end, here's the final map. We thought we'd be at 34%. We wound up at 54 with phenomenally good weather. So here's the map currently of what's completed along the territorial sea. And here just a couple of eye candy shots. This is around Redfish Rocks. Here's one around Cape Perpetua. So these data that you're seeing are about 1 meter resolution. So this is excellent quality data that can be used for multi-use for the tsunami modeling, habitat mapping, and so forth. And here's Haystack Rock offshore. And here's what Cape Arago looks like underwater. So after the data is collected, then the next step that OSU did was create habitat maps from the data. And here are just some of the steps going through backscatter intensity and going through a semi-automated process to produce habitat maps, which eventually look something like this. And so OSU did all the habitat mapping. The data acquisition was done by a combination of OSU and Fugro International and David Evans and Associates, an Oregon company that's a contractor to National Ocean Service. And so the data is now online. It's been online for about a year. And here's the download page here. It's going to be online in a more interactive sort of mode pretty soon. Hopefully next month, actually. And so when you go onto that page, what you get is a series of 19 maps that look like this. Here's there are 19 sheets that are shown in these small boxes up here. And so this shows the substrate at about a 1 meter resolution for 54% at the margin. And here's just a close-up of what Newport looks like. And so these are available as hard copies, as PDF files, or as GIS data sets for download. They're public domain data and available to all. And then shortly we'll have an interactive server where you can go on there and select the data you want in a little more user-friendly way than the present download page. And that's the status of the project as it stands today. The funds are expended, and the project's wrapping up. All the infrastructure still exists to do the rest of the territorial sea, should that ever come to pass. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before Mr. Bush goes on, I just want to point out to our new members on the committee that this project is part of just a giant fabric of issues and tasks that we needed to put together to get a lot of things to happen. And that individually they are not sexy or exciting in themselves, but when you think of it, it takes a long time to get from point A to point B at the end, and as we go we're always finding things that we need to tweak or change or enable or something in order for things to happen. And you can tell just by Dr. Goldfinger's presentation, this has been a very collaborative effort that encompasses a lot of different sectors. So I just wanted to use that as Mr. Bush will talk about the ocean energy end of things. He heads up the Oregon Wave Energy Trust.
Thank you. Chair Bailey, member of the committee, my name is Jason Bush. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. We're a nonprofit, and our mission is to promote the responsible development of ocean energy. It's that responsible component that has fueled our investments and efforts in promoting the understanding of the ocean. The Territorial Sea Plan, which was completed in January, is a product of several years of data collection and public meetings, over 100, in which we collected information from all over the coast, including a great deal of data from the ocean. And as a result of the interest of the ocean energy industry in Oregon, we have more data and information about the ocean than we've ever had in Oregon. So it's been a major contribution to our understanding. For example, OET helped pay for something called called Oregon Marine Map, which is now a online Google-based data a mapping system that allows you to see where all the different things are that are happening in our Oregon Ocean, such as the bathymetry, dredge disposal sites, subsea cable routes, shipping lanes, kelp beds, pinniped haul-outs, and lots of others. In fact, over 150 data layers. So as a representative of OET and of the industry, I think that continuing to provide information to the state about the ocean is consistent with our mission to promote the responsible development of ocean energy. And so we're here to support Representative Boone's bill, House Bill 2694, and the Dash 1 amendments. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative, do you anticipate any other changes coming besides the Dash 1 amendments?
I think that we are, and I'm going to let Mr. Bush answer that in detail if he has such detail. But yes, we have an amendment that will that we're putting forth, and this the little changes that we will make it clearer and conclusive of the types of, we've just said data, and what we really needed was Dr. Goldfinger's definitions of what this data includes.
That's correct, Chair Bailey. The there are two issues that we see. One is addressing the sort of generic language that was used, and that's my generic language. And I reached out to Dr. Goldfinger, who provided the specific information that we're actually looking for, such as the recommended language he provided was shared geologic and geophysical data from the Oregon Territorial Sea, including bathymetry, backscatter, seismic reflection, and sample data. I think that's more specific and appropriate as an amendment. The other piece was in the section one regarding when the data should be made available. So the intent was to make sure that the data would be made available once the company or developer had actually received their permits. At that point in time, it becomes part of the public record, and providing the data is completely reasonable. But to require a company to provide that before they've actually received their permits is to release proprietary information that they've spent money on trying to derive and could be used by another company to compete with them for that particular site. And so it seems to make sense to make the information available only after the permits have been received.
And that's not a problem. It's actually best, because one of the underlying features of this whole idea and moving this forward is, as you saw, only 54% has been completed, and so we have another 40-some percent to go, and we're trying to be efficient in our use of the funds that are available. Or, you know, right now, if we let them, they would probably continue on at the lab mapping, but they're going to be going grant to grant. There's another bill that will be coming up that Oregon State's research vessels, and that includes one of their top priorities is to work on a seafloor mapping project through the lab. So we're trying to get this project finished in as expeditable way that we have. Is that a word?
Expeditious.
Yeah. It is now. So we're trying to save money. We're trying to get a good product done. They do excellent work. You might remember, some of you, Marine Map was a bill that came through here in order to put Marine Map into being, and any one of you can sign up on it and look at it. It's just another piece of those many pieces to get this thing done as we learn more and more about the ocean. So,
great, Representative Reardon. Thank you, Chair. Do you see this as something that would be important to economic development on the coast? Any of you?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Just let me give you a little example, though, that one thing that happened or didn't happen, as the case may be a couple years ago. There was a ship going through from South California to Washington State, I think, and we got a call from somebody saying, you know, hey, we got 2 weeks' worth of work we could give you if you could come up with the cash to buy our supplies and food or whatever to keep them going while they were waiting for their next job to do. And it was going to be about, I don't know, do you remember this, Dr. Goldfinger?
No.
Okay, it was something about, I think it was when Jessica was here, about $30,000 we were asking somebody to find, you know, sweepings on the floor of Ways and Means Committee meeting or something. But things like that happen. But what my point is that these people come to our communities along the coast to do the job. And it's not just it's not in Corvallis. I mean, the lab is, but the work is done on the coast, obviously. The goal from, you saw the points that were spread out among the different prioritized areas on the coast. So anywhere from the north coast to the south coast to the mid coast at any given time, and I'm not sure how long they go out, but I think you're limited to the summer months pretty much. And wherever they go to complete the priorities in those orders. And I think the first ones were marine reserves, tsunami. There's some tsunami. I think wave energy is number 3 on the prioritized list. I've got the list here if you're interested. But the point is they are here and there. They're not just starting in Brookings and moving north, or starting in Estuary and moving south. So every time they're in the area, they're staying in hotels, they're eating in restaurants, they're buying food, groceries to stock the ship, and maybe they're seeing movies, I don't know, buying souvenirs, and, you know, whatever.
Great town.
Okay. If I can just add to that one little thing, is I'm a geologist, so I think long term, and so I'm one of my interests is also in really preserving what we have on the coast, and in addition to into building it up. And subduction zone earthquakes are going to do a lot of damage along the coast, and the way to become more resilient to that is to do good modeling and plan ahead. And this is kind of a long-term thing. And getting the bathymetry data so that you can do decent modeling is the very base level of becoming resilient for tsunami.
And for those of you who don't know Dr. Goldfinger, my other committee in Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, we yard him out in front of us regularly to talk gloom and doom about that very event. And he's been around the world, and he's a renowned expert on earthquake and tsunami damage. And he can tell you, he can just reduce you to a puddle. But he's always doing it with a smile. So he's well-rounded, and he knows what he's doing. And we're very lucky to have him doing this project.
One tiny, small one.
Follow up.
Thank you. Does the seasonality of your data collection actually affect? In other words, do you need to go back and do the data collection over and over again, different times of year? Or is that important?
No, that's a great question. Actually, the things in the nearshore waters do change from season to season and year to year. And at this point, we're really just trying to get to a single baseline. And the single baseline isn't going to account for that, unfortunately. It would be incredibly expensive to go back and do this over and over and over again. It's probably never going to happen. So we have to accept a little bit of uncertainty because things will change.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just to build on the tsunami discussion. Has your mapping or your study progressed to a point where you can show the difference between your modeling as a result of your mapping compared to what we had before? In other words, can you point at that and say this study is worth it because the modeling has changed so dramatically and all of you folks should be really happy for the exercise?
No, that's a great question. So the state effort to do modeling that's mostly being done by George Priest and Ian Maiden at Dalgami and Vicki McConnell has been going along parallel with the seafloor mapping effort. So we would feed them data to work on Florence or Bandon or Seaside, whatever the case may be, just in time to do that. And so yes, it does make quite a bit of difference. And the difference is really not so much that our data shows that the wave goes twice as far inland or half as far, but the data, what it really is just much more defensible, because when you go to the people of a town and say, look, you may want to consider moving your school or your fire department or whatever, if you don't have solid modeling underneath that, it's not going to be taken very seriously. And that's mostly what this does, is it puts a solid foundation under that.
Thank you.
And if I can add to that, he brings up a very good explanation, working side by side with Dogami and their LIDAR so that you get from the ocean 3 miles out to the shore, and as it goes onshore, just as an example, in my district, the inundation maps have changed a couple of times since we started, and there's some incredible work that has been done. They actually built a sort of a mock-up of Seaside, and I know they've done it in another city now. And then at the Wave Lab at Oregon State, they program the water to be, you know, representative of a wave this high, and this is what it would look like. And you can see, you know, if you live there, you know which building's what, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not going to go there, I'm going to go there. Because they show, and then they have computer models of what happens when the wave comes in, if there's this many people on the beach. And, you know, it's just been very instructive in our area, and it's so instructive that now the Seaside School District is talking about moving their whole campus, you know, en masse up above the inundation zone in Seaside onto former timberland, and that will be an evacuation center as well and a place for people to go when the thing hits. And they're doing the same thing separately in Cannon Beach, but moving these schools out of the inundation zone, because the inundation zone really is the whole city. So keep that in mind this weekend when you're down there for Dorchester. Stay off the beach. No, I'm kidding.
Representative Whiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You guys kind of touched on what I was going to say as far as just projecting what's going to happen. I was just wondering on consistency of a current hitting in a spot, eroding in that spot, so you could project, hey, it's going to be over here in 10 years or 20 years. But my next question since that one's kind of been dealt with a little bit. It's on the energy resource side, and as far as putting some of starting to generate power off of waves, however we may do that, have we really done a lot of studies with running electrical lines underneath the ocean floor just to see if it's going to affect fish migration, things like that? Do we have any real detailed information on anything like that at this point?
Do you want to take that or start if you want to follow that?
Okay.
In short, the answer, committee member Wider, the answer is yes. There have been hundreds of studies. What you're referring to, of course, is electromagnetic force or EMF associated with the running current through any cable, any electric cable, any machine has EMF around it, any electrical machine. EMF has been studied for many years because there are thousands of miles of electrical cable in the water, both electrical cable sending current as well as telecommunication cables. And as a result, there have been a lot of studies. As of 2 weeks ago, the federal government, Department of Energy, put all studies related to wave energy or ocean energy in general in a single database called TETHYS, T-E-T-H-Y-S. I think it's the Life of Neptune or some such person. And there you have a cumulative body of all the research that's been done. And there are certainly some takeaways from EMF. It is still, the short of it is that there are impacts. They appear to be fairly minimal. And there's more work to be done in general. But in the case of Oregon, the approach that we took with the territorial sea plan was to integrate a precautionary approach to ocean energy to ensure that, given that we don't have perfect information about any of this stuff, if we are going to move forward, it needs to be done in a cautionary precautionary manner of what's called phase development, one device, and then a couple more devices, and then five more, and 10, and 20, and each time looking and responding to the new information that we're receiving. And so that's going to be an ongoing effort. EMF is just one, sediment transport is another, but that's certainly built into our system here in Oregon to deal with that sometimes lack of perfect information.
Do you want to add to that, Dr. Feldfinger?
If I may, I would just add to that, Representative Wiedner, is that some of my colleagues at OSU are involved in those EM studies, and that's obviously a point of interest for groundfish, for whale migration, pinnipeds, or what have you. Once the studies are done, the key will be to integrate that information with all the other impacts that these things might have. They'll have impacts on humans, on fishing, on navigation routes, even on military training routes offshore. And the trick is to integrate all that stuff into some kind of sensible decision framework. And so we're also working on a decision tool that'll help do that in a logical way and try to use actual data instead of just a room full of people hollering at each other to make a sensible decision.
I may follow up.
We're a little bit off topic on this particular bill. Is it on the same subject?
No. Other than Representative Vega Peterson was wondering if Dr. Goldfinger had been in a James Bond movie.
We've never gotten that before, Dr. Goldfinger.
I got into the first one free, though.
And with that, we will close the public hearing on, seeing nobody else wishing to testify. Okay, thank you all very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2694. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2516. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2516 allows the Watershed Conservation Operating Fund and Watershed Conservation Grant Fund monies to be used by the Oregon Department of Education acting on behalf of one or more school districts. It allows the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to establish a program through the Oregon Department of Education that provides funds for elementary school hands-on learning programs related to protection and restoration of native fish, wildlife habitats, watersheds, or ecosystems.
We have Rex Burkholder, Claire McKinley, and Eric Vines to kick us off.
Great. Thank you very much, Chair Bailey and members of the committee. My name is Rex Burkholder. I'm one of a broad coalition of citizens in Oregon who are in support of Outdoor School for Everyone. You're here today to speak in support of this bill. Outdoor School has provided quality science-based education to Oregon youth for over 60 years. Outdoor School has a proven track record of encouraging young people to pursue careers in science, the natural resources, as well as in education. Also giving these young, eager learners a chance to learn about what really makes Oregon special, our nature and the out-of-doors. As a school-based program, Outdoor school historically has been delivered to every child in Oregon, urban, rural, eastern, western, abled, and disabled. Yet today, only about 40% of the Oregon youth attend outdoor school. And this number is dropping every year as school districts struggle to find funding. We simply can't afford to lose this Oregon tradition. In your information, or it should be coming to you soon, is a map of a study done by the Gray Family Fund. And what the red tells you is places where there is no outdoor school programming, and the green shows you where there is some or a significant amount of outdoor school funding. But you'll recognize, in terms of equity issues, this is an important issue, and this is really why we are coming to you at the state, because on the local level it's become very difficult to maintain this program. And our ask for you today is to pass House Bill 2516 onto the Ways and Means Committee so that we can work with our other partners out there to find sufficient and stable funding for outdoor school for every child in Oregon. And with your permission, I'd like to show you a short video that shows how dynamic and special this program is.
Please.
And you know how to run it. I don't.
We'll see. And perhaps we can turn down the lights a bit. Is there sound for it?
There should be.
I can barely hear it.
You can hear it a little. There you go.
It should come right through.
You started early?
That's what we always say. It worked earlier.
We're waiting for that.
Yeah, we're waiting for that. Why don't we go on to the next testimony?
Great.
Sure, I can do that. I'm Claire McKinley, and I'm currently the soil field instructor at Sandy River Outdoor School, where everyone calls me Arkin. At the end of each week, the student leaders, who are high school volunteers, and our staff, we reintroduce ourselves to the sixth graders with our real names and our occupations outside of outdoor school. And each week I stand up and say, my name is Claire McKinley, and when I'm not a field instructor, I operate an inductively coupled plasma emission spectrometer named JY. Which is really just a cute and fancy way of saying that previous to working at outdoor school, I was a lab technician, analyzing chemical composition of sediments in the lab where I did my undergraduate research. My involvement in the outdoor school program is the single reason I pursued a science education in college. In the fall, I will return to school to pursue a graduate degree in earth sciences, where I hope to study the interactions between volcanic ash and the global carbon cycle. I attended outdoor school as a sixth grader, and like so many of our students, I cried on the bus ride home and was determined to return in 4 years to be a student leader, a goal I achieved as I spent 5 weeks of my high school career volunteering for the program. The lessons I taught to sixth graders about properties of soil was my only exposure to the earth sciences curriculum that I received in high school. Everyone who comes to outdoor school experiences the practical and ecological applications of the natural sciences they learn in their classrooms. Our students learn plant identifications, animal adaptations. Our students learn what pH and dissolved oxygen measure and what those measurements indicate to us about the health of water or soil. Our students have the unique opportunity to make observations and perform experiments within the environment they are learning about. A week of outdoor school is a well-developed marriage of scientific experiences, conservation education, and community building. Currently, only 40% of the students in Oregon attend some form of our program. And by supporting House Bill 2516 and moving it forward, you will be investing in outdoor school. You will be investing in young scientists like myself, young community leaders, and a population who will continue to be concerned about conserving our natural resources. Outdoor school was my gateway to a love of the natural sciences, and I am indebted to the program and to my own field instructor in a way I will never be able to repay. In this time when we are asking important questions about the future of education in Oregon, questions like how do we encourage students to be interested in math and science, how do we improve test scores, how do we instill a sense of stewardship in the next generation, outdoor school is a program that offers answers to these questions. It was the answer for me, and with your help, we can provide the same opportunity to all of the children in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. How are we doing on the video here?
Yep.
Representative Kenny Geyer, would you like to come join us? Why don't you come on in and we'll do the video after that. Please.
Thank you for squeezing me in. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer. I'm the representative for House District 46, which is parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm really happy to be here. This was a committee I was on last year, and I really miss it.
We miss you.
I just wanted to come and say that I've been a part of the work group that put this bill forward, and I know there may be questions about whether this is the right funding mechanism, but I think it's really important that we and you as a policy committee on the environment make a strong stand in support of outdoor education programs. I've had three children who have gone through that. They're all past sixth grade, so I survived that. But it was an incredibly important program to them, and this is the kind of program that can benefit, if we as a state really support it, benefit urban and rural kids. It's a huge opportunity for us. I represent an urban district where we have many children who fall below the poverty line and don't have access, aren't fortunate to live in some of the areas of the state that have immediate access to natural resources. And this is one of the few opportunities that they can really get out and have an appreciation for natural resources and the need to really protect that. So I just came to give my very strong support for the program. And I know there are a lot of other people who are going to talk to the specifics of this. I hope that it gets passed on to Ways and Means and we can talk about what the appropriate funding mechanisms are for it. But I think it's really, really vital program. I appreciate you considering it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We'll let the representative get back to her business. Any questions for her before she goes? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And are we ready on the video? Not yet. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about this bill today for Outdoor School for Everyone, HB 2516. My name is Eric Vines. I'm the Executive Director of the Gray Family Foundation. And our main interest is to bring age-appropriate experiences, outdoor experiences, to every child in Oregon as part of our educational system from early childhood all the way through 12th grade. Outdoor school is one part of this continuum, and it's something that we think is very necessary. We know from research that we've conducted on outdoor school that it helps kids learn. It immerses them in science, math, reading, music, art, physical activity, and it's an engaging experience that deepens their learning at every single level. And here's the part we love the most. This actually helps to create engaged citizens, which is really what the Gray Family Foundation is trying to do. It helps them when they grow up to connect to this place that is Oregon through this very intensive one-week outdoor experience, and they don't forget it when they grow up. They engage with their parents by wanting to go fishing and camping. They want to use the parks. They want to go ride their bikes. They want to go to the beach, the desert. They want to visit the trails that are protected by land trusts. They want to volunteer with watershed councils, and they want to go birding. They suddenly get interested in gardens and growing food. They also discover a self-respect that doesn't always exist before they attend these programs. Basically, they want to get involved. John Gray loved Oregon, and he was concerned about the public's understanding of land use laws and how they would affect communities and the state. Our position as a funder of these programs and outdoor education experiences that we believe, and we have research to demonstrate, that getting kids outside is a major component of developing engaged citizens. And as a state, we've done some amazing work already to create the parks, to protect the lands, to improve watershed councils, and to improve forest health. But unless we get our kids outside, away from the screens, we're going to have a generation that does not understand the work that we've done already, what we've done to protect the forests, the rivers, or the parks, and why it's worth continuing. As others have mentioned, about 40% of the kids today get to have this experience, and we funded the research to identify exactly how many kids are getting to go to outdoor school. If you're in private schools, it's more like 74% of the kids get to go to outdoor school. We owe it to our kids and our future selves to make sure that every Oregon child gets a shot at this transformative experience in this program. Whether you go or not shouldn't depend on whether your teacher happens to write a grant, whether you happen to live in the right county, or whether your parents can afford to write the check. Every kid deserves this experience. I think we should acknowledge the questions that are coming today and the concerns about the funding mechanism that this bill recommends. We are strong supporters of OEB and the Land Trust, and we don't want to take away their money for restoration efforts. But I think that the broad coalition of folks and people who would like to see outdoor school become available to all kids is hard to ignore. And people love outdoor school. It makes a strong case, I think, for moving this bill on to Ways and Means so that we can find and work together to find the appropriate, stable funding source that will allow all kids to go to outdoor school. So I think the benefits to Oregonians are too great to let this wait, and I really appreciate your time today. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And if the previous two panelists would like to come up, we'll take questions for this panel. We have media services on the way to
do
technical troubleshooting. Questions for this panel, please. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now, what is the funding mechanism for the program? What percentage-wise does it cover of the program, and what is the ask? Because it looks, I don't have the bill in front of me, and I don't, am I reading a bill on this? I've done it, but, so I don't, thank you. Anyway, I just was wondering those questions and how would it go, what is your envision, what you envision in happening in Ways and Means?
Sure. And I don't have the answers to all those questions, but I know to a certain degree many of the programs are funded now with a real, it's mixed, school by school. Sometimes it's coming from the district level. Sometimes it's an individual teacher who's raising the money for her class to go or his class to go. In some cases in the metro region, the local metro government provides a portion of the funding, and it's really cobbled together from lots of different sources. Schools and will write grants to the Gray Family Foundation, and we will fund a portion of the experience. But none of us have the resources to fund it entirely for the entire state at this point.
And if I can give you some idea of the scale, there are approximately 45,000 youth in sixth grade in Oregon every year. And if you were to send them all to the traditional five-night, six-day program, that would come to about $17 million totally. There are, as Eric said, lots of different sources of dollars. And currently, though, many of the programs that do exist have been reduced from that six-day, five-night program to 3 days and two nights, which is considered kind of the minimum possible to provide the kind of experience and education that outdoor school has been able to provide. So if simple way for me to think about it, if you take each day, if you can send every sixth grader to outdoor school for a day, that's $3.4 million. Okay, so every day, about 3.4. Can we provide some of that backing on the state level? And then there's lots of local partners. There's the school districts that also work to contribute. The goal is to provide some base of support. I'd go for the whole thing, but, you know, I know times are tough. But so what we're looking for is the opportunity to go and look for funding to provide that base of support so all school districts can provide this for all their sixth graders.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of comments. The bill as crafted suggests the money would be taken basically out of the lottery funds for OWEB. The way I read it, I would not support that. Just so the record is clear, for many reasons. But that's not my question. My question is this: and I went online and found some information, and this statement kind of captures my concern, and it's an old one. The distinction between advocacy and education, because we're all in favor of education about the environment, but we're not in favor of advocacy. And so the fine line between those two, pretty difficult. And in the bill, it appears on line 27, 28, it appears a couple of times, educate students concerning the protection and restoration of native fish or wildlife habitats, watersheds, and ecosystems. Who could argue with that? Except that, that context in that that concept is counter to what we try to do in the state to keep it going. And so that balanced approach is what I'd sure be interested in seeing. I haven't heard it so far. It may well exist in the program, but you would need to bring that forward and show us mm-hmm. the balance. and that would mean seeing exactly what the kids are being taught so we could understand it better. And broad generalizations won't work. We have to see what you've actually been teaching. So how would you recommend that you could show us that?
Well, to start answering your question, I think what you're asking is how much conservation advocacy is occurring versus talking about the way that we use natural resources in Oregon. Is that sort of what you're getting at? Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I put a finer point on it?
Okay, thanks.
In general, I like to use mining as the device, because if one goes into any literature with kids, mm-hmm. modern day literature, mining is almost always painted as being bad for the environment.
Okay.
And I would love to see how mining is discussed in your classes and see if there's something written down. It would be great to see it, because the bias many times is absolutely clear. And what ends up happening then is we have a level of children mm-hmm. that emerge predisposed against activities that may make their lives actually better. And so the question becomes, how do we craft that balance? Because we're all interested in having kids that know about the environment and know the importance of protecting it. And at the same time, we've got the small matter of paying the bills. So how do we strike that balance, and how can you show us that that's what you've been doing?
Well, you should definitely come visit us and see the program in action. But we do try to teach like both sides. So, for instance, on Plants Field Study, lots of students learn how to calculate a board foot and look at like how much lumber would come from a particular tree. On Soil Field Study, which is what I'm responsible for, we teach about how soil is formed and then also how the pH of the soil impacts agricultural issues. So, like, if you wanted to grow what plant and which thing, like if you wanted to grow a specific plant, how would you need to change the pH, or what pH would you need? So in addition to looking at conservation issues, we look at how natural resources impact jobs and what jobs you can have there, and then also things like how lumber resources get used within the environment. I hope that answers the question you're asking.
Sure. I would comment that you may want to also follow up with the education co-chairs about the contents of education across the education spectrum and any curriculum that might be taught in our public schools.
And, Mr. Chair, you are exactly right, and I appreciate that comment. I don't think, other than the general statement you just made, which I appreciate, today we're not going to get what I want. It's going to be a material you might provide us with that shows what is being taught, so that we in turn can then see if this is something that indeed deserves the support you're asking for. And that would mean, what is being taught and how can you show us? Because you're one teacher among many, and if this passes, many more. How will we know what that curriculum is? So it'd be up to you guys to show us.
And we do have that for a couple of the counties at least. We'd be happy to share that with you.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit for, well, not the full group, but we had this discussion actually in my office and funding it and bringing in people from the outside, because I actually have four boys and myself, so five of my family members. I think my wife might have even went to outdoor school. She's a little older than I am, though it may not have been around then. But that being said, is what Representative Bentz was going after, is some of the stuff that my kids ran into with some of the teachers that were there. And I kind of broached, you know, getting with some other groups like Weyerhaeuser, Boise Cascade, and reaching out to them for funds and bringing in experts who are very good at land resources. Like, the state does a much better job than the federal government on managing our lands here locally, but we could even do a better job. I'm just wondering if those discussions, if you were planning to go forward with them to look at those avenues, because they'd probably fund your whole program because they want to educate people and teach people how to use the lands properly.
Well, again, I'm the layperson here. As someone who went through outdoor school myself, my kids went through, and had my work when I was at Metro was about how do we get the message across that Metro had in a much more effective way. And our focus was actually on waste reduction. And we have done a lot of evaluation, a lot of curriculum checking to make sure that the delivery of the curriculum is good. And it's about how do we use our resources more wisely. And that's what Metro's, one of Metro's main missions is actually solid waste management. We all get the grief for land use and transportation, but it's about recycling, which is really what most of what Metro does. And the work we've done there has been, and I think that's an important question to ask, because what you want to do, and part of the reason why you do want funding coming from all of us, is that you do have a way to make sure there is that balance. There is participation and partnership by a lot of private sector companies in the support of outdoor school currently in the current funding mix, and engagement in there as well. And I think the issue of curriculum is a key one, and you want to make sure that your evaluation is, and the programs are high quality. And this is the work that the Gray Family Fund has really pioneered, because it has been a hodgepodge of, based on a lot of times now, since the last few years, just the initiative of the local community, a local teacher. How do they get the best quality out there? Well, partly is providing some stability in funding and support, but part that comes with that is some consistency as well. And I think that's an important issue that we have to think about, is how do you get that consistency of message out there, and then also have that oversight of what are you trying to provide. I just want to tell a quick story, because I went to outdoor school, and I really encourage you to come visit. If we don't ever get to see the video, it's a moving thing to see these kids. And I was there on the last day, and there was a group having the discussion about the timber issue. Okay, they had just done the board foot of this stand of timber, and they're having a discussion about, well, what do you do with this? And, you know, it starts out with these sixth graders going, oh, you have to save everything. And then the discussion led by the instructors was, well, what kind of house do you live in? What's it made out of? Oh, it's made out of wood. Okay, well, don't you think we need some houses? And, well, what do you do about that? Maybe a smaller house. Okay, have that discussion. Talking about, okay, what do you use in school? You use paper. Well, where does paper come from? Comes from the trees. Well, how much, you know, that balance issue I thought was amazing, and the kids were actually really good about pushing back at each other, and the instructors were really good about encouraging that kind of Socratic dialogue about these choices we have to make, and which, again, I think is a critical role that outdoor school plays, is create those critical thinkers who look at these key issues that are very difficult. Mining is a classic, very difficult one. I just saw the special on the Rogue River on OPB about what early placer mining did to the community and the fish runs and such. You know, responsible management of that will be critical in the future. How do we do that? We have to have educated people who understand those trade-offs. And I've testified longer just on answering your question than I did my testimony. I meant to be short. But I'm pretty passionate about this. I think it's a very important program. The state has a lot of stake in our kids, and this is a way to invest in them.
And then one real quick follow-up.
Please.
On the map here, just looking at it, this is Representative Bent's area. Do you think they probably don't go to outdoor school just because they're born outside to begin with?
Pretty much.
He said there's nothing out there.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I was going to make a similar point to Representative Widener, but we heard earlier that, you know, there would be a desire to try to reach more kids across the state, and there are some underserved portions of extreme northeastern Oregon and southwestern Oregon, but I would make the point that many of those kids in those areas, in fact, live in ecosystems every day. That's where they may live on a cattle ranch, they may live on a big timber stretch or whatever. And myself, growing up in the Upper Hooter Valley, you know, I lived one of those kind of lifestyles. I played in the streams. I worked in the orchards. I had friends whose fathers were timber fallers and so forth. I knew that we needed ample snowfall on Mount Hood to supply the irrigation water every summer to provide the water for our agricultural crops and stuff. So you understand that because you live in it. So I just wanted to get on the record that students across the state who don't necessarily have not had access to this program are not necessarily impoverished. Obviously, in an urban setting, it could be very illuminating for some kids who live in the concrete jungle, if you will. But I just want to make sure we don't try to treat all students across the state of Oregon with the same broad brush. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we'll have the
quick comment.
Yeah.
The one thing I have not heard come up, and this is a comment, not a question, if it's all right.
Please.
And no one really mentioned the leadership opportunities that are provided by the older students that go, because we all dwell on the cute little sixth graders. They're still cute at that age. But I had my stepdaughter went back twice and served as an outdoor school counselor. I had some of my own students that went out and served as counselors. And the leadership, I mean, if you can imagine trying to guide a dozen sixth graders for a week and get them all to the right places at the right time and teach them the classes and all of this, I mean, it's just a phenomenal opportunity that you get really very few other places. So I would definitely put that in your pitch for outdoor school. And the other, I think there would be a question in here somewhere, I've got to get a question, is wouldn't the curriculum be different in different parts of the state?
Yes.
Thank you.
I see head nods.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
All right. Head nods. Accepted.
I think a key thing to remember, though, too, is that the curriculum is based on the state educational goals, especially in the areas of science and technology and math and such. So in that sense, you guys have set standardization or hopes for the curriculum outcomes and at all grade levels. And that's a key part, even though the how you deliver it and some of the content may be different. The fact is that it's all based on supporting that schoolwork that those kids do in the rest of the year.
Right. And if, can I add just a small to the point about I grew up on a farm in Montana, and so I had lots of outdoor experiences, but I also really appreciated the opportunity to go camping with my parents and to go to the coast. I mean, some of the benefits of the outdoor schools is they don't always happen right in the backyard of where the kids are living, and they get to actually experience different ecosystems around the state. So sometimes they'll actually take a trip to go see the coast, or the kids in the coast will go inland and spend some time in the desert, and that's a real benefit, is to get exposure to wide different geographies in the state.
Thank you to this panel. Appreciate it. We're going to have the committee stand at ease for just a moment while IS works on the
put you outside your comfort zone. It just is.
When they first started like talking like, oh yeah, we're going to Camp Numanu for outdoor school, I'm like, oh, my sister, like, she said it was very wet. It's not really going to be exciting. I don't get to bring my hair straightener. I'm like,
The kids come on Sunday and they're really anxious and nobody really knows each other, and they go to bed that night really quickly and quietly. And then Monday evening and Tuesday, they start norming. You know, they start finding a routine. They start realizing that it feels really good to them to be asked to move around so physically and learn at the same time, that it feels good to be asked to communicate with people they don't know.
There are a whole bunch of people that I don't know here, that I didn't even know existed.
Mostly what we want to do on Waterfield City is get them to understand, you know, what makes a healthy body of water.
So as temperature goes down, dissolved oxygen was going up.
The dissolved oxygen in the water really dictates what kind of life is going to be able to live in that body of water. And it's really cool that they get to go through a scientific process in determining that.
Super scientific missing message.
Adding different chemicals into the water, mixing it themselves, adding the drops and counting the drops to determine how many parts per million are oxygen parts.
It's like orange, like my goggles.
We went critter catching in the pond.
Right there. I got a lead.
There you go.
Oh my gosh, it's so cute.
And then just let it go in the water.
Perfect.
A lot of it is hands-on.
If you get your hand wet, you can gently pet it. But the oils in the skins are really not very good for them.
Kids can connect the concepts that we're teaching with real experiences that they're having. Creating those memories and those experiences is really what we're about here.
How's it look now?
I remember thinking all the student leaders were incredibly tall and just the coolest, tallest, largest, oldest people I'd ever met.
My student leader's name was Toro. He was a sophomore at Grant High School. I still remember his name and his high school. I remember exactly what he wore all week. And I remember his mannerisms.
It's kind of different because our teachers are like a lot older, and like they're not as young as like our cabin leaders.
Forces you to just open yourself up more and, you know, just not be so shy and afraid to talk to other people.
And it is sort of terrifying to be put in charge of 12 young children.
The cabin leaders, like, they always like being like shout songs.
And then you smash them, you smash them, you smash, smash, smash them, then you spread on the bed.
1, 2, 3, 4. Peanut butter and jelly.
And here we're asking them, you know, not only to speak in public, but to sing in public. To get a group of girls ready to go to a field study, to teach at field study, to be a leader, not just to people younger than they are, but to their peers. They're not scared to be loud or their fullest self out here. They know that it's important to play those team building and group games because they can tell there's a vibe in their cabin that's different.
Nurse
Our weeks have been halved. We used to run a 6-day, 5-night program, and now we're running a 3-day, 2-night program.
You only have 2 days to bond with a cabin. It's a lot harder than if you had a full week.
I really wanted people who came to Outdoor School in its new form got as much of the old experience as they possibly could. We knew we had to come back this session, these next few sessions, because they were going to be really important in keeping the legacy of the program alive.
Where water flows to a common point.
They only learn half the material in each field study, but they still get the general feel of Outdoor School from it. It's something that can really never be replaced.
Outdoor School was like a miracle place for me, you know, and I've seen it be a miracle place for other students and student leaders, and I'm just not willing to let that go.
Mr. Beiler.
And Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. It's never an advantage to follow kids talking about issues.
That's why I called you up.
well played. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2516. OWEB is neutral on the bill. I do want to relay to you today for the record, and we're passing out testimony on for this as well, some concerns we have with the bill as it's drafted currently. I also want to tell you that I went to Outdoor School, both as a sixth grader and as a counselor, and had a great experience. It's a very enriching opportunity for kids to get outdoors. There's no doubt about it. At the outset, before I kind of walk you through some of the particulars with respect to this bill and our program, I want to thank Representative Bailey and the sponsors of the bill for bringing this issue up. And it's good timing for OWEB in particular. We've been funding conservation education over our history for a number of years. It's never been a lot of money. Our old funding, Measure 66 funding, we'd never had a whole lot of that in our grant program to allocate, but we were able to probably average about $1 million per biennium for conservation education related activities. And now under Measure 76, and I'll talk about this in a little more detail, we still fund those, although we have a much narrower bandwidth in terms of how our dollars can be used. What I'd like to say also at the outset is that this bill has been a catalyst for us to have some conversations with folks from the Gray Fund and from the Oregon Community Foundation in particular. Some conversations that that were started about 4 years ago when I sat down with John Gray and some other folks to talk about opportunities to partner. And unfortunately, we didn't follow up on those issues in a timely manner as we could have. But there were some things that occurred during that time period that actually probably were beneficial for us not to have gotten too far down that path. And one of those was the passage of Measure 76 in 2010, which made some adjustments to our lottery fund, which is our primary funding source. With respect to the bill, we're neutral for a couple of reasons, not because we don't like outdoor school, but we have some questions about the necessity for the bill. The bill proposes to make some changes in terms of eligibility of funding for our funds that would allow for our funds to be used for these purposes, for conservation education purposes. And we have two essential funds within our program, an operating fund and a grant fund. And under the constitutional dedication of funding for our program, the operating fund is already eligible for education purposes. The grant fund does not expressly note education as a purpose. It does, however, mention outreach. So let me walk you through where we're at today with respect to our ability. With respect to our current budget under Measure 76, OWEB does not have discretionary funds available to it under our operating funds. Those funds are all distributed to programs and state agencies, OWEB's, Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Agriculture, and I think State Police, actually, in their Fish and Wildlife program. So those funds are essentially used to help support those programs that are relevant within the context of the purposes of ballot Measure 76. Historically, under Measure 66, not 76, but Measure 66, again, we'd had some resources available for these types of projects, and outdoor schools could apply for our funds and receive support. I don't know conclusively today whether we have examples of a number of different types of projects that we've supported that are very experiential, like outdoor school, but some of them are not all week camps. They're different types of experiences based on the desires of local communities and their ability to apply for funding through our program. So under Measure 76, under this, and this is the first biennium where we've had those the sideboards of 76 for our dollars, we haven't had operating funds available to be able to support these types of activities. We have, however, interpreted outreach as a potential use for our grant funds fairly broadly to include project-related efforts that are kind of outdoor classroom opportunities. And so this biennium, we have supported some of those efforts, but it's a fairly narrow bandwidth. So I want the committee to be aware that there are limitations in our funding with respect to the degree and extent that it can support these types of activities. That said, we have been in supportive of these types of activities over the years. I think when I look at our investment history, it shows that the importance of these types of investments and the desire for those. We are, again, interested in being able to continue to be a partner in those types of opportunities, and hopeful that maybe this is a catalyst for some conversations for us to work with the Oregon Community Foundation and the Gray Fund to look at ways we can strategically assist each other in those efforts. So on the bill itself, one of the concerns we have is that the changes to allow for the conservation education out of our operating fund and our grant fund aren't needed, because we are able to do that today as we manage our programs. Whether the funding is there or not is one of the questions. The second item that I wanted to mention to you is in the first part of the bill, where it references Department of Education eligibility for funding. We are concerned that that may run crosswise with Measure 76 and the way the Constitution is set up. It prohibits the distributor, the administrator of these funds, in this case OWEB, to disperse these funds to state or federal agencies. And so that area is one that I would just want to give you a heads up on, of an area of concern, and that would need to be looked at down the line, I believe, as conversations on this bill continue over time. I guess I won't belabor this too much, because I know you've got a lot of other people who want to testify, but I do want to express my interest in continued conversations about ways that we can be a partner in this. I do think that that's how OWEB operates. That's how we'd like to approach things. I'm not sure that we are the silver bullet or the answer for the bigger picture opportunity and interest that the bill proponents have expressed, but I do think that we can be a contributor, and we'd like to be able to be part of those conversations as they move forward. So with that, I'll close my testimony. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Great. Before we take questions, I'd just like to say, Director Beiler, thank you for your engagement on this. We appreciate your constructiveness in looking to find a solution on this bill. And I just ask, would you say that there is a nexus between the education portions of the Measure 76 funds and the kinds of activities that Outdoor School has?
Chair Bailey, absolutely. And if those funds ever become available and discretionary for our OWEB board, it would be a great opportunity for us to make these types of investments. I would say that it's particularly important now with Measure 76 that has a long-term funding horizon for us to be, for our program, investing in the community, not just in the habitat, which is a primary purpose of our grant funds, but for these operating funds, being able to invest in the community through these types of opportunities would be a real priority for our agency.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Beiler?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Beiler, we didn't ask the previous panel, but do you have any idea what the potential ask would be regarding what kind of monies we're talking about would be to the department so that they could distribute for this program? Do you have any idea what the quantity would be?
Chair Bailey, basis, Representative Johnson, it depends on how you define the ask. In part, we receive applications for a wide variety of different purposes in addition to outdoor school type of activities that are conservation education. Over our history, we've received those. They could be weekend camps. They could be daytime experiences. There's a real variety of experiential opportunities out there for children. I know that we've never had enough resources to cover the demand out there. I do know that I think we heard today that there's some estimate that for week-long outdoor school experience for all students in Oregon could be $15 million a year and annually, perhaps more. I'm not the expert on that, and I certainly would encourage anyone who knows better to correct me if I'm misstating that on the record, but it would be a significant need.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Beiler, we've talked about the measure of the good that your agency does and how to get a finer point maybe on proving the value of how you're spending the $40 million a year, $80 million of biennium. Do I have that right?
That's close, yes.
That the agency has available to spend. And the numbers I've heard, rumors only, nothing that I've seen, is that the ask here was $20 million, which would be about 25% of your total budget biannually. And my question is, have you reached a point of being able to measure those outcomes that you're achieving now? and give us your opinion. Is this the type of thing that we should be spending, let's say, 25% of your budget upon, given the other choices that your agency has available? And since it's a tough question, feel free to point out who would make that decision if who would do that weighing and balancing. Would it be your board? Should it be us? Who?
Chair Bailey, Representative Bentz, thank you for the question. The we are constantly asking ourselves and acting toward being able to measure the return on our investments. Over our history, the bulk of our funding, the vast majority of our resources have gone towards on-the-ground types of projects, and we're making progress on being able to track those outcomes. We still have a long way to go. In terms of our history of investment in conservation education, I think we have less experience and capacity to be able to understand the value of those. And for that reason, I really value the opportunity to work more closely with the Gray Fund folks and Oregon Community Foundation, because I believe they have greater capacity than we do as an agency to be able to track those and measure those investments so that we can understand the return on those. So we don't have a great history in terms of being able to understand the return on those on the conservation education side. It's not been an area that we've had internal capacity around over our history.
Paul, and just for context for the committee, we have three more panels of people that wish to testify today.
Actually, this kind of leads into the discussion they're having. I was just kind of going through it with Measure 76, and it was passed by 70% by the voters, but I don't think constitutionally, looking at this, that we can even touch it or use it for this. So I might even wondering with the grant funding and stuff, if you're really able to do that, we may want to check with LC on this, because we're stepping way out of bounds from what the summary and the intent of this bill was. So
happy to check on that. Thank you, Director.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Eric Beck, Bill Hoyt, and Matt Clark, please. Gentlemen, thank you for your patience. Whoever would like to start, can start. Actually, I take that back. We're going to have Matt Clark start, because I think he has another engagement to get to.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Clark. I'm the director of Johnson Creek Watershed Council, which is based in Portland. Wanted to begin by saying that I am supportive of the educational outcomes that this bill is intended to promote. I say that as the director of Johnson Creek Watershed Council, and then I say that personally. I have a 3- and a 6-year-old that I hope go to outdoor school. And I'm sure you can hear many people say today, I myself am a product of outdoor school, and it was a very meaningful experience to me. My concern is very brief, that I see the value of the creation of a statewide outdoor school program. My concern is diverting funding from other programs like restoration, on-the-ground restoration, and conservation education that is already being done. To my mind, the concern is by doing so, we would essentially be robbing Peter to pay Paul. So that's really all I have to say. In closing, I'm supportive of the concept of outdoor school. I'm concerned about the funding mechanism for it.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for giving me a chance to speak here. My name is Eric Beck. I live in Bend, Oregon, and I'm a middle school teacher in Bend, Oregon, public middle school teacher. And I'm here in opposition to Bill, House Bill 2516. I've been teaching in Bend 11 years. I've been working with the Upper Deschutes Watershed Council there for seven or more of those years, and have I have some submissions here. They're just a small sampling of some of the work that my students are either currently doing or have done in the recent past, a couple articles that highlight some of the impact that my work with the Watershed Council has meant to the students in Bend. And Bend might, I don't know what color Deschutes County was on that map because I didn't get a copy out there in the audience, but...
Dark green, sir.
Yeah. What's that?
Dark green, sir. Dark.
And what does that mean?
Is it? Oh, I thought 26% was crook is dark green. Yeah.
Okay. You know, we might be characterized by some as one of those counties where the kids, they're kind of growing up in it. But I know that, you know, with my students, even though we have a lot of open space around us, if they don't go out with me, if they don't go out with the Upper Deschutes Watershed Council, they're not getting out. Or they're getting out, and they're getting out only in one capacity and not getting a complete understanding of the science and grappling with the issues on the public lands, you know. And that's what I try and do with them, is to get them to see multiple sides of the issues. And the Watershed Council is the perfect venue for doing that. And I'm worried funding-wise with this bill. Nothing. I did not go to outdoor school. Unfortunately, I was not born in Oregon. I was from Illinois, and we didn't have anything like that. I think the spirit of sending money to outdoor school is great. Environmental education, getting students out and working with public entities and on the ground in the field is a cornerstone of the way that I teach, and I definitely believe that all students should have access to that. I'm worried that the reality of the bill with the funding stream is that it's going to divert and dilute the really good work divert money and dilute the really good work that's going on at many watershed councils with students around the state. And I would hate to have that disrupted because of the funding going somewhere else. Our Watershed Council is already doing super powerful work. It's locally based. It's with real scientists. Through the Watershed Council, I've connected with and worked with local irrigation districts, with PGE, with the ODFW, with the National Forest Service and the Deschutes Children's Forest, with the City of Bend. And my students have gotten connected with the real scientists, with the real experts. They're doing real science. They're collecting real data. And they've been incredibly inspired to continue to change their career paths, to continue the work that we do not both sides of the issues, but on all sides of the issues, and really and getting that view. And I think it's really important. I heard somebody say earlier that there's a lot of value in traveling and seeing other parts of the state, and I believe that. My passion is with getting the students out in their local areas, though, also, and having them become stewards and have a sense of ownership where they live and a place where they can continue to take their families and to feel that connection there. And I also feel strongly about the connection from kindergarten through high school with the students, because they're at different places at different times in their lives. And middle school, 7th and 8th grade, and that freshman year, they're in a very powerful place where we can have a huge impact on them. So I would hate for the funding that is distributed now to be limited to a smaller age group of students. You know, my students change their view of science from the work that they do with the Watershed Council. They change their view of their home. They change their view of themselves. And they get inspired to continue the kind of work that I do with them and that the Watershed Council does with them when we get out in the field.
If you could wrap up your comments, that'd be great. Thank you.
In closing, I urge you to oppose it because of the funding pathway there, and to keep in mind that sometimes the most directive way to affect a lot of students is to get the funding directly to the local entities who can then do the work in their local communities with the students.
Thanks very much. Sir.
Chair Raley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Hoyt. I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I'm the legislative chair. We would like to support all of the efforts to get kids out on the ground. We think that hands-on learning and outdoor experiences are paramount in any the upbringing of any child. And we, our members are actively involved in farm-to-school programs. We are a fifth-generation ranch. We're doing some different things, and we have, through the Agribusiness Council, brought fifth and sixth graders to the ranch to look at composting and alternative plant growth and alternative ways of farming with no-till drilling and those kinds of efforts that were made in ag-related issues and looking at all sides. We also believe that it's very important for any hands-on outdoor experience with to have a really holistic and balanced approach to seeing the multiple different sides, and I can give you issues related to anything that is in the natural resource area this is a very complex and needs to have a very broad look at how we deal with solving problems. This bill simply takes too much money away from what we see is on the ground projects and restoration that is being done and by OEB that's been invaluable all over the state, and we think that there are different ways that we can go about addressing what this bill wants to address without taking money away from OEB and for the projects and the good work that it's doing. And with that, I will close my remarks and ask for any questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for this panel, Representative Reardon?
Thank you, Chair. Question for Mr. Clark. We've heard a lot of comments today about things that are happening on the ground, and I'm absolutely a supporter of outdoor school, but I'd also like to hear from you, if you would, what are some of the things that have been happening on the ground at Johnson Creek watershed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, thank you for the question. Well, in several realms, so in terms of restoration, we are doing a lot of work to restore a sort of nascent return of salmon in Johnson Creek, and so we do a lot of in-stream work and planting trees by Johnson Creek, and that involves a lot of work with volunteers. So one of the things that we really focus on is, and you know this because you were out with us, sort of a softball question there. You were out with a bunch of volunteers this past weekend removing invasive weeds and planting trees. One of the things that we've done in terms of service learning is a program with high school students called Youth Engaged, where they are at sites in Johnson Creek doing water quality monitoring and other inquiry-based learning, and that is coupled then with service activities such as planting trees and removing invasive weeds. And the marriage of the inquiry-based learning and then the service activities has been very powerful. So, would you like me to expand on that?
How many salmon are we seeing?
Well, we saw 4 spawning coho this last year, which doesn't sound like sounds like small cause for celebration, but for Johnson Creek, that's very exciting because they have not been seen for years. So we're very excited about that.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much, Sean. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me go ahead.
Absolutely. And we'll call up Jesse Jones and Kelly Beamer. And I'm going to screw this up because I can't read the handwriting. Is it Jerry or Jenny McKesson? Sorry. I'm going to guess Jerry then. Maybe I'll call you a doctor at this point with that handwriting. Whoever would like to begin, please.
Chair Bailey and committee, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Jesse Jones, and I'm a Watershed Council Coordinator for 4 Watershed Councils in the North Coast, including the Napa Region, Nicolay, Wickiup, Skipanon, Young's Bay, and then down south to Ecola Creek. I'm going to follow up on a couple of things that Eric said. There is a new story for outdoor education in Oregon that needs to be told. Since 1997...
And if you back just a little bit away from the microphone, it'll just get less.
Sorry, I have a hearing problem. So. Watershed councils in Oregon have been steadily engaging students in natural resource activities in their communities and inspiring natural resource curriculum. These small organizations are a year-round local resource for outdoor and natural education opportunities in their communities, although education is not funded by OWEB. organically because of the work that they do in their local watersheds, their activities like tree planting, culvert replacement, road decommissioning, water quality monitoring, fish salvage, just to name a few of the projects that my councils do, have attracted local educators who are keen and thrifty. You see, watershed councils all have an objective of outreach and have done a really good job at this with limited funding. Watershed councils have been working with schools and teachers for years, opening children's eyes and hearts to their local flora and fauna. Watershed council coordinators are known in their communities as the salmon lady or the tree guy, and available year-round to incorporate students into implemented projects, working with watershed partners like soil and water conservation districts, and bringing in skilled biologists, hydrologists, engineers, and zoologists. Hundreds of K through 12 kids could tell you about their experience in just the last year in the north coast of Oregon. Funding outdoor school with OWEB dollars could undermine and disregard an incredibly positive and unintended consequence that watershed councils have had in their local community over the last 10 or 15 years. I urge the makers of this bill to take another look at the objective and to visit the students involved with their local watershed councils. Consider how OWEB dollars used for restoration are having an incredible effect on the minds of children in the communities they work. Watershed councils have been providing, with their partner schools, place-based natural resource education throughout OWEB's history and have an excellent track record. This bill is written may take money away from the very restoration projects in these communities that local kids are learning from. Thank you.
Ms. Beamer.
Thank you. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Beamer. I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Oregon Land Trust, COLT. We are a 501c3 nonprofit that represents 18 individual land trusts from across the state of Oregon. Our mission is to serve and strengthen the land trust community of Oregon. A little bit about land trusts. Land trusts work with willing private landowners to obtain conservation easements and acquisitions that protect water quality, protect wildlife habitat, and preserve open lands in Oregon. The members of COLT have collectively worked to save and protect over 50,000 acres of private land. And I just want to begin by commending all of those in this room who worked really hard to invest in outdoor education with kids who are working to support programs that connect kids to the land. It's an incredible effort here, just represented with those individuals who are testifying. Experiences like Oregon Outdoor School are critical to forming our next generation of stewards. In fact, many of COLT's members run active programs that provide outdoor education experiences for children, using their properties as living classrooms to demonstrate the impact and of restoration and provide opportunities to monitor fish and wildlife. The land trust community wholeheartedly supports funding outdoor education, and we are very interested in working cooperatively to find a long-term and sustainable solution for outdoor school. However, we have concerns about the specific mechanism proposed in HB 2516. As you have heard, this bill would use OWEB conservation operating funds and conservation grant funds to support outdoor education for elementary school students. Many of COLT's members receive OWEB grants to carry out critical acquisition and restoration projects pursuant to Measure 76. While outdoor education is a core value for many of COLT members, the way in which this bill pursues outdoor funding would pull resources from existing programs carried out by land trusts and our partner watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts. The Coalition of Oregon Land Trust strongly supports natural resource education and outdoor at school programs and is aware of the difficulty encountered by local schools in delivering such programs. Unfortunately, HB 2516 proposes to tap into an already oversubscribed funding source, which the voters established expressly for the purpose of protecting and restoring critical fish and wildlife habitat. The Coalition of Oregon Land Trust supports efforts to find a long-term sustainable funding source for natural resource education that does not divert funds relied upon by land trusts. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Chair Bailey.
Chairman Bailey, members of the commission, for the record, my name is Jerry Nicolescu. I am the executive director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, and I apologize. This is the second time I've been mistaken for a doctor when I sign up. I will work on my handwriting. I had a little different experience with outdoor school. It started with going outside school boundaries in the third grade to catch frogs in the swamp next door and making the teacher walk out to get me and not wanting to come in, and she was not happy. My education started when my parents found out and I got home, and that the education began at the end of a shovel every night after school and with a weed whacker, which at that time was a hoe. So my education was a little different, and it came, and it is in one of those areas that Representative Widener indicated probably got it on a regular daily basis. But anyway, my association represents 45 soil and water conservation districts in Oregon, and they provide the technical and financial assistance to landowners and land users to voluntarily implement conservation on the ground. They accomplish this in a variety of ways, all beginning at the local level and being built upon and based upon prevailing community thoughts and values. Today we discuss House Bill 2516. OACD, in representing districts, is opposed to this bill. We stress we are not opposed to education of elementary students in any way, shape, or form. For example, all districts are required to track their outreach and education activities. In a review of outreach and education activities, student events, and classes from July 1st, 2012 to September 30th, 2012, the time of the year when most schools are not in session, 13 districts conducted 47 events at 52 schools that reached 2,645 students. This is without outdoor school. This was without OWEB funding. Districts are very much aware of the value of education to youth. We agree wholeheartedly the idea of increased opportunities for education of elementary students. But we also think that there are many more ways other than outdoor school to do that, and that there we should have a broad basis of that education. However, the identified funding source that we has been brought up before is a fully utilized source, and I think that if to shift funding from those activities would seriously undermine the very examples that we want kids to see out there, and we need to keep that in place. It suggested maybe we take a small step back, involve a greater group of stakeholders, consider what is already in place, and then seek to find a better way to do this. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the panel? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to welcome Jesse. You're my constituent. Welcome to the Capitol. And thanks for taking the time to come. It's becoming apparent to me that everybody seems to want the same thing, but it's just how to get there is the issue.
And nobody wants to pay for it.
But yes. Yeah, well, there's that. But I just, this is the kind of thing where the more I hear, you know, all the good work that's happening in different areas and different sectors, and Representative Benson and I have been talking about the differences in our districts. It's all valuable work, it's all good work and everything, but you're absolutely right. It just seems like it's a funding thing. So it's not that, you know, I don't hear the people who are opposed to the bill per se as being opposed to the work that the bill proposes to do. It's just the matter of funding. So,
do you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay.
I never get to talk. I think that we should form a work group of some sort, if that's, you know, if that looks like where it's going. And I've done it before on other areas, solar energy, et cetera. And they seem to be, sometimes they're easier to do in a couple of meetings. And I'm sure they'll come up with something. See, a lot of nods.
Was that the question?
Further questions? Mm-hmm. Representative Widener.
Was your weed whacker called a sigh?
No, mine was called a hoe.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And we'll call up Ryan Gordon and Katie Fast, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I would say I'll keep my comments brief. Farm Bureau shares a lot of the concerns that you've heard earlier with previous testimony, that the funding source through OWEB is critical to on-ground voluntary projects that are collaborative with agencies and landowners. Right now, we are in, I think, a critical need around weeds programs, water quality programs, and collaborative projects with watershed councils and SWCDs, and would be concerned about the impact that adding funding through OWEB for Outdoor School would have on these current programs that are being utilized. Very supportive of leadership programs that deal with nature and the outdoors, and as other organizations, we are participating in those currently. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Bailey and committee. My name is Ryan Gordon. I'm the executive director of the Network of Oregon Watershed Councils. And the network supports the efforts of over 80 watershed councils statewide that work collaboratively to enhance watershed health and benefit their local communities. Community outreach and education is a key component of the grassroots approach that councils take to building relationships with landowners for watershed restoration. And I don't know if it's an advantage going last or not. I'm not sure that I can add much more to the discussion here. You've already heard from several councils the perspective that I would be bringing today, and that is that councils broadly support the educational outcomes that this bill is intended to promote, but they're really concerned about the potential implications for funding for the really good work that they're doing. And there's also been plenty of concern and discussion around this funding mechanism, obviously, from previous testimony. I would say that councils in urban and rural communities, as you've heard and you've probably seen through some of the written testimony that's come through, have really leveraged OWEB funds to forge partnerships with schools, conservation districts, state and federal agencies, and local organizations to create really great place-based educational programs that address locally recognized needs. And these programs also include local volunteers, local community leaders, and expose youth participants to a broad range of issues that are important in their local natural environment. And I think they really help to create pathways to lifelong involvement in natural resource related issues, because they help them to understand how they can be involved locally in their community. The second thing that I would say is that to the extent that this particular funding mechanism could take funding away from restoration work that happens on the ground, I would say that also is really a loss of those living classrooms that I think Kelly brought up in her testimony. When I look around the state, I see a lot of restoration work creating places where not just youth but also community members are engaged. They're going out and learning about how they're being impacted directly by restoration work. They're understanding what it's doing and how it's benefiting them. Beyond that, I would say that these living classrooms also help to support a broad range of university programs and research, and they're just really an integral part of not only a lot of the outreach and education that's going on around the state, but also continuing to improve our efforts to restore watersheds and natural environments. So in closing, I would say, quoting a council coordinator who may have written to you, I'm not sure, he said, many things are best done locally, and that's what watershed councils and their partners are all about. And I think that with that perspective in mind, councils are really more than willing to collaborate and think strategically about youth education in much the same way that they have done so for restoration. And just to echo what everyone else has said here today, that I think councils are really open to sitting down and having this discussion and thinking about how we can really capitalize and potentially even expand some of the really great work they're doing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions for this panel?
Okay. Thank you
for your time. Thank you to everybody who took the time to come today to testify on House Bill 2516. Seeing nobody else who wishes to testify, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2516, and committee is adjourned.
Gracias.